for somewhere around 20 minutes each. And we're going to start with Bob, and then Sandy, and then Clancy.
I'm Bob Bazans. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Sober through the grace of God and AA since the 10th of December 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I am here because Tom I could not make it. There was originally three wise men, now it's two wise men and a smart ass. And thank you, honey. And we are, I guess, have the opportunity to talk about whatever we want to talk about for 15 or 20 minutes. I want to talk a little bit about, I'm up here with two of my heroes. Clancy is literally a historic figure in AA, so we have a little bit of living history here. And Sandy is my very favorite person in AA to listen to. He is, today he is my Chamberlain. He says things that I can hear from him that I can't hear from anyone else. So it's always my great pleasure to be with my friend Sandy. One of the differences is when I came in, you wouldn't be sitting on a podium with two guys with 50 years of sobriety. They didn't exist. I mean, they may have existed, but they weren't. He was, I don't know what it was, 67? You know, so it was 32 years old. When I started going to conferences, the talks, well, let's talk about the group. The groups were smaller. They were more family-oriented. Almost everybody was married. The average age was probably 45 years old. Most people had a profession, whether you were a construction worker or whether you were a lawyer. And their pants were in fire. They burnt have come close to burning their marriages down and their careers down. And they were trying to get their life back. Today, the average age of people coming in, you know, what is it, 25? I don't know what the number is, but it's a hell of a lot lower. They don't have careers. Many of them have spoiled their educations. They are not churched. We have far more drug participation than we used to with Alcoholics Anonymous when I came in. So it's, you know, who we're, and it's not married. You know, so it's much more single. So the social aspect to me of what I see in Alcoholics Anonymous is greater than it was when I came in. The groups when I came in were almost all home groups. They were, and people clung together. You know, they talk about in the old days when Dr. Bob, you know, they had one meeting a week in Akron and one meeting a week in New York, but they were together seven nights a week. I mean, when they weren't having a meeting, they were gathered at, you know, houses and doing stuff with the actual group and doing stuff amongst themselves. Today, our society has become a little less home group oriented, and we're more like a meeting society. I see that as one of the biggest changes that are going on. You can go to a lot of groups, and you're just not exactly sure who's there. So that's a big change. The relationship with the steps that I see is more complicated today. It is more technical. It is more teachy. We are more formal with the big book than we have been. Joe and Charlie, I think, initiated a renaissance in Alcoholics Anonymous with the big book, and I think that's been one of the great contributions that we've had in our fellowship. But it is different. People would never hit you over the head with the big book when I was new. I don't think too many 50-year-olds would kind of stand for the, we didn't use the Bible in those days like, or we didn't use the big book in those days like the more conservative people would sometimes use the. And I'm just drawing these changes in that we live in society. And Alcoholics Anonymous in some ways is different. Society is a hell of a lot different. I mean, hell, you can sit in your bedroom with a computer and you can do pornography, gamble, and order drugs. I mean, whatever happened to Bob? Oh, he died. What happened? He starved to death. He never got out of his bedroom. I mean, it was, different. But most, the essence is the same. The essence is still having people come in here whose lives have, you know, broken down through alcohol. And they come in here and they, what Clancy talked about, they had the gift of identification. What gave them the gift of identification was surrender. Until they broke down, they would not identify. Prior to the surrender, that didn't happen. And thank God when it did happen that that was there. And it was mostly the power of example. It was mostly, you got the problem, we had the problem too, and we found a way out, and this is what we did. And there was a real desperation to follow that path, and I think our success rate was pretty significant. And I think today I see mostly good stuff. It's different, but it's mostly good stuff. I see a greater dedication to the book. I see much more formalness in sponsorship. I see much more formal activity in the steps. I don't think, you know, when I look around, I don't feel like, I know, I think the worry with old-timers is that, you know, the idea that we're going to hell in a handbasket and we're not doing it like we used to do it. And we aren't doing it exactly like we used to do it. But we are not going to hell in a handbasket. And it's evolving. And we are part of the society. And it ain't going back. I mean, you know, we may try to stand up here and say, we're going to take it by the horns and we're going to take it back to the way it was in 1960. Ain't going to happen. And, you know, and it doesn't need to happen. But we do need the dedication and the primary purpose, and we do need the participation and in the book and in the steps and in the program to have it be intact so when our children and our grandchildren need this program that they can come into the rooms and be offered the same program, the same steps, the same recovery, the same God, the same truth, the same sponsorship that we were offered. And by and large, I see that happening with great regularity. As I haven't traveled the country quite as much as the gentleman, well, not nearly as much as Clancy and not as much as Sandy. But as I travel the country, I don't feel like we're being invaded by people who don't belong in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are being invaded by, you know, a group of people who look a little different, talk a little different, and their experience is slightly different than what it was when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But in my experience, they still feel like drunks to me. They do not feel like they're not. And if I was out there today, I didn't have a drug problem, didn't take any drugs. But there's something about me that I just don't think I'd say no thank you as much as I would. So I think there's a chance that I would have had more experience with that. As I came in, the thing that really gives me courage is the problem is not going away. It is still the biggest problem that we have in society. Alcoholism is still the largest drug used. It causes, all the estimates that they talk about, the damage it causes in homes and the damage it causes. And there is no other answer. You know, like it was before Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, where would you go to get help? Other than renting a donkey and go to Damascus, I mean, there was no literal answer. Medicine was not particularly effective in dealing with alcoholism. Psychology was not particularly effective in dealing with alcoholism. And religion probably was the most effective of all the different majorities that came in. The problem's not gone and it's not going away. And the answer is in these rooms. If you were gathering people together, I know the people today, there's some social criticism because we're so kind of anti-religion today. Our society has never been as secular as it has been. So people are kind of critical of AA being kind of a God deal. But what else could it be? I mean, if you don't find a power greater than yourself, what do you have? I mean, don't you have what you had when you walked in the front door? If you don't find someone that you can rely on and access to help start change the direction of your life, you're going to be self-directed. I don't know if there's ever been a greater formula for problem in the world for an alcoholic than being self-directed. You can want to have it as much as you could possibly want to have it, but if you don't open up to be able to hear something outside of your own head, most of us would say that you're just kind of doomed because you've got a disease that condemns you to drink. You can't stay stopped, and once you start, you can't, you know, the craving comes in and you can't stop. And that problem is exactly the same as it has always been. I think it's just astounding that we have a program today that is as fresh as it has ever been. I mean, you're sitting up here with people who have had, 50 years of sobriety, and we just gave a couple of big books away to some brand new people, and the steps are as pertinent and as appropriate and as powerful and as necessary as they have ever been. And I don't know. I know that when we start talking about what the history of AA is and what the future of AA is, there isn't anybody in this room that really isn't pretty damn concerned. And I think one of the things that happens to you is when you get sober for a long time, I mean, most of my heroes are dead. You're looking at a couple of people up here that are, extraordinary people of the generation, Chuck's generation. How many people are left, if any? If Clancy was of a different generation, I mean, Chuck came in, 47?
46.
Clancy came in 58, 12 years later. I don't know what a generation is, 20 years, But of the generation that we're talking about with Ivester and Immisland and the different people around today, how many people do we have? How many people of the real horses that were pulling those wagons? I mean, most of them are gone. And it seems to me that most of us, when we look at it, the guys that are coming up behind our heroes, it seems like it takes more of us to pull the wagon. Seems like, who's going to pull the wagon Clancy pulled? Well, it ain't going to be one person.
What's that?
It's good. But the good news is there's going to be a couple of us that are going to be able to, maybe it's three or four of us that could pull that wagon. And that was how we felt when Bob White died. When we took a look at, our hero and took a look at what he had done. And that's what's going to happen. Everybody's got to step forward and take their part and take their wisdom and make it available, to keep the integrity of the program, keep it intact, unchanged. Unchanged in the program aspect, but it's going to change in the societal aspect. You can't stop that. It's going to be what it's going to be. It really has a lot. We are not people who are going to have one person stand up and say, this is the way it's going to be. It just isn't going to happen. But the message we have is spiritual, it's not societal, it's not psychological, and that never changes. The essence and truth of what is the strength of our program is unchanging. And that is why we can sit in a room with 80-year-olds in the room and 30-year-olds in the room and 20-year-olds in the room, have the same discussion with the same steps and having it be vital and important and integral in all our lives. So my hope that I see in the future is in a fellowship that I think today is pretty strong. One of the questions is, are we growing? And I don't know, it's one of the hardest things to evaluate. If you judge the sale of big books, we'd certainly think we were growing. But as you take a look around, the other factors, I'm not sure what the answer is to that question. But if each of us just replaced ourselves, and if you wanted to just think about that for a moment, AA would be an extraordinarily healthy place. If that's all we did, sometime in the next 5 years, replace yourself. Bring a new person in with the problem and introduce them to Alcoholics Anonymous, introduce them to the steps, sponsor them, and have that experience. You don't have to sponsor 10 people or 15 people or 30 people, but replace ourselves. I was a guy who had a lot of abilities and never was able to use them, and I walked into a room as lost as I could have been, and I was welcomed in a way that was astounding and offered a program that I thought was going to resolve my problem and turned out to give me a way to live. Chamberlain, in A New Pair of Glasses, when he talks about being outside that meeting the first night when he goes to the meeting, and he's standing outside and he's pausing to go in the door, and the guy at the door looks at him and he said, "Can I help you?" Or he said, "Are you looking for something?" And he said, "If it would interest you, I'm looking for sobriety." And he said the guy's face lit up like a candle. He said, "What I didn't know, what I was about to find, was a way that was going to teach me how to live." And thank you for that.
Uh-huh. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sandy.
Thank you for the cake and all the kind words. I really get choked up. I don't like to talk about myself, but I'm going to tonight. I want to share something. I've had some health issues for quite a while that have made it hard to travel. And I started finding out that my spiritual program wasn't as strong as I thought it was. When pain came and stayed and stayed, and as time went on, I realized that if this was happening to somebody else, I would completely understand. But my spiritual arrogance refused to cut me any slack. How could this be happening to you? You put together this connection, this conscious contact, and it's supposed to be unbreakable. And of course, I found that boy, selfishness was coming in and snapping at other people, and it was just a real interesting inventory of yourself that you can only have when something like that happens. You can't make it up and have a hypothetical situation. And so the latest is that this thing is similar to a perfect storm. There was all these events that took place, starting with knee replacements, the pacemaker, getting one hip replaced, a lot of groin pain, then another hip replaced, then a congestive heart failure, then I lost 40 pounds of muscle mass, and then they're trying to get me through the physical therapy, I tore the rotator cuff twice in the right shoulder. And so everything was working against making any progress. And so diagnosis and all this. So the latest guys are convinced that the only way out is physical therapy. And I'm scheduled in a month or so to start. And I'm just, when I tried to get up that step, I'm going, this is going to be quite a workout over at the, because I've done a lot of physical therapy. But about 4 months ago, the right side started, and so the pain level doubled. And I'm going to share with you the one thing in AA that benefited me the most. And it really surprised me. It's the basic AA meeting. Showing up at an AA meeting. And starting about 4 months ago, the morning is very hard. Just getting dressed and showered and all that takes about an hour and a half. But I'm getting to the noon meeting. I'm going to get out there at 11:30 in my car, and I can get the walker in the trunk. Initially, people were giving me rides, and I said, "No, I'm going to get this. I'm going to go by myself." And that really did feel good. But on the way over, I would have to tell myself, now be nice to people. Because, some of you are going to be, how are you doing? What kind of an outfit is that? That tie doesn't match that. And then I'd go, God, now you got to go make an amend to that guy. So be nice. Try to be nice when you go in there. And so I would get there early. And eventually the meeting would start, and I like to sit. They have some church benches, and I like to sit on this bench. They're really cool. This is a noon meeting in a club. And about halfway through the meeting, about 4 months ago, I felt myself lifted off the bench. I could feel it was God. I was lifted out of myself into God, and I saw the meeting in the fourth dimension. I saw everything that was happening at that meeting. And I could see how happy this person, they were. It was almost like you know, 3D showed up in the movie, in the meeting, and it made everything worthwhile. I remember saying to myself, I'll go through this just to have that happen again. And it happens fairly often. And here's the thing that struck me. That's exactly what happened when I started. 49 years ago. We're in all that pain. And you're sitting there. And something happens halfway through the meeting. You remember that? Somebody would say something. And you just go, boy, am I glad I'm here. And you knew that you were in the right place. And so it just made me glad that I understand that I don't go to AA because I like it. I go because I have to. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm not somebody that could take the meetings and, oh, it's fun. I like being there. I have to be there. My life depends on me receiving help on a steady basis. So every anniversary, people say, how'd you stay sober? I said, I want to be receiving help all the time. Receiving help is one of the hardest things to do in the world. When I first started out, do you want me to help you walk up? No. And then I'd fall, and then they'd go, okay. You think back on how easy it is for you to help people, but how hard is it for you to ask for help? And that's how we avoid returning to self-sufficiency. Somehow we seem to want to go back to the old rules of life. The more things I can do on my own, that I'm independent, I can take care of this, and no, I don't need help. I used to when I was new in AA, but I don't need help anymore. That's a terrible place to be. It is the exact opposite goal that we want to have. Ideally, we would just become more dependent and more dependent and more dependent until we just were a channel. Anyway, I just wanted to share that. And then I always have thoughts on AA itself. All the meetings I attend are better than ever. They're wonderful. But AA isn't just composed of the groups around the country. There's other parts to it. And if you look in our service manual, and we are a bottom-up organization. The ideas are supposed to come from the bottom. We're supposed to look around and go, what could we do to improve AA? What could we do? What could we do? Well, in order to do that, you have to pay attention to what's going on. And myself, I do that by reading the General Service Conference Report. I read all the pamphlets. I read all the speeches of our trusted servants. And then I evaluate them myself. It says in one of the warranties that the right for a member or a group to evaluate their trusted servants is supreme. It's the highest value that we have. So it's part of our responsibility to become aware of what's going on the big picture. And I came up with this measuring stick. And I think you can't get it any simpler than this. Are our servants moving us closer to God or away from God? And I would say the answer to that question would hold two different futures for AA. If in fact it was moving away in order to be more inclusive, to grow, to whatever it is, this would not be good. That's one man's opinion. If on the other hand, we continue to move closer to God, How do we do that? We talk more about it. We're delighted that this is a God-centered program. And if the outside world thinks we're too religious, let's do a better PR job. We're not, we haven't gone religious. This is a spiritual, God-centered program. And so that's why I bring this topic up, out of fear that someone who has reached the point of desperation, which is the only time the human ego is opened up enough to enter, let God enter, and we don't offer the gift, and perhaps we just show them how to stay sober by going to meetings, and we end up where the guy has pretty good sobriety. What a terrible outcome compared to what it could have been by having a connection with his creator. Thank you.
My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage. Bob said all the things I wanted to say, and Sandy picked up the rest, and I may just sing a few Christmas carols. But the problem of AA, certainly, I think I'm not quite as optimistic about it as some. I think that we have a lot of good AA, but I think there's a lot of bum AA out there, too. Some years ago, I was talking in liberal Kansas, if there is such a place, and I was groping to try to explain what I was trying to reach, and I stumbled upon the phrase, pockets of enthusiasm. And it just seemed like no big deal, but next year they had a pockets of enthusiasm conference there. They use it all over the country now. I never get any royalties. I never get anything. But I would say it is true in the United States and around the world. There are pockets of enthusiasm surrounded by vast areas of gray AA, unenthusiastic, blah, one meeting a week, let's not do anything outside of that. And these pockets of enthusiasm are the future of AA, I think, because those are the people who are involved and excited and doing things. And they're not so rare. I mean, Sherwood, our speaker this afternoon from Las Vegas, he belongs to a pocket of enthusiasm in Las Vegas. It's a growing group, and they're enthusiastic, and they do things. And Bob is from an enthusiastic area in the Twin Cities. And I don't know about Polly and Dave's place, but by the way they sound, I guess it must be a good place. But in these pockets of enthusiasm, there's always one thing present. There's always a strong sponsorship ethic. That's the one indivisible thing. Because with a strong sponsorship ethic, you are forced to do things that you would not do left to your own devices. You would postpone them. I know that when my, it's ridiculous bringing up my history because it's not widespread, but I know when I came to AA, Bill Wilson had 23 years of sobriety, and everyone agreed no one would ever get near that amount again. This was just like going to the Holy Land. And now people, 23 years, I send for coffee. And if they have enough brains to get it right. I made a move tonight that was better. I found myself sitting next to two Al-Anons, and I dispatched them to get my coffee. They did it right. Good for you, girls. When I was struggling early in AA, I want to tell you this story. When I was struggling early in AA, I learned a little game to play with my employers. I would say things like, they'd call me in and say, we really need you here Monday too, or when you come in Tuesday, you smell bad. And I recognized the axe about to fall. And I learned something a long time ago. I said, You're right, Mr. Carlson. You know, I got drinking overseas when I saw all that horror. As the veterans card was always a good one to play. But they have this thing downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd heard about that. I'd gone to some meetings. They were dreadful. And I said, if you let me go there, I'll learn how to stay sober in a couple of weeks, and I'll be back and we'll do it. He said, good idea. Because at that time, AA was not very well known. It was just kind of a mysterious thing where old drunks went and never came back. They didn't know what the hell happened to them. Maybe they were eaten by somebody. But it never helped me much. But I want to tell our ladies that got me the coffee. I was very glad, though, because I could go home and tell my wife, well, Charlotte, I've gone back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she would smile and say, oh, that's so nice. What do they want you to do, honey? And I'd say, well, they want me to taper off. And there was no Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been any moment's rest for anybody anywhere. Now you're supposed to stop complaining. We have the same steps you do. We have the rib. We have a book, too. I release you, you son of a bitch. But I don't know what that has to do with anything, but I mean, it's a nice story. Tell you another nice story that has nothing to do with anything. About a month ago, I heard our dogs barking in the middle of the night. And bark, bark, bark. And I went up to the front, see what's going on. And I looked out the front window, and there was a guy sitting on the little wall in front of our house. So I opened the door irately and said, what the hell are you doing out there? He said, I'm going to a lecture. I said, a lecture? About what? Alcoholism. I said, where in hell in Venice, California, is there a lecture on alcoholism at 2 o'clock in the morning? At my house. And I'm glad to help them. But it's kind of interesting to be old in AA, because I don't remember ever being old in AA. But I remember when Sandy, when he was talking, I remember when he was brand new in the 1960s and perky and bright and one of the most loved people I ever met. He had a wonderful Saturday morning meeting that we talked about the steps, and I've gone to that, and just a great thing. And there, he ran around with two other guys who are both dead now, but great AAs. And that's the saddest thing about growing old in AA. All of my chums are dead. All of my companions. I mean, there's a lot of people. I have a lot of friends. I work with new people, and I go places with. But it's different when you're. It's a different generation, as Bob said. It's a different generation. They have different tastes and interests, and you feel like such an old fuddy-duddy. And that's the way AA is, because AA is. I believe AA is getting away a little bit from where it was. I remember a year or so ago, I spoke at the World Service Center, at World Service Office in New York. They asked me to come up there and talk. And I talked. And at the end of the talk, for the first time ever, they didn't say the Lord's Prayer. They said the Serenity Prayer. I said, how come you're saying the Serenity Prayer? And I offended some of the people. And the director said, she said, because it offends people and we'll do it the way we choose. And I think that's wrong. Bill Wilson said that when they asked him, why do we say the Lord's Prayer? He said, I guess it's a hangover from the Oxford group. They always closed their meetings with the Lord's Prayer. So when we had meetings, we'd close them with the Lord's Prayer. He said, and if there's nothing really offensive in the Lord's Prayer, and if some people don't want to say it, they can just remain quiet. It'll be good for their tolerance to learn to do that. And I really can't understand that. There are some countries in the world where they've never said the Lord's Prayer. You never hear the Lord's Prayer in England or Ireland or Australia or New Zealand or many of these countries. They don't say it because someone has said it offends people. And I don't understand that at all, because I know nothing in the Lord's Prayer that isn't in or implied in the 12 steps. It really is the same thing. People say, well, The idea that it came from Christ offends me. Well, the fourth step offends me, too. But this is not designed to tailor for my taste. It's designed for my recovery. I look back at the years I slipped around AA, almost 10 years, in and out, and I went from being a high-bottom drunk to a medium-bottom drunk to a low-bottom drunk to being without home, family, or anything, and living in an abandoned car briefly after I was sober. And I think, what made the difference to me? Why did I stay sober? And all the people who used to laugh at me are all gone. And I'm the only survivor. What kind of justice is that? And I think the reason is because what I talked about a little bit last night. If we are lucky, we go here and we hear identification. Someone gets inside that invisible mantle that we've used to keep off any help or advice. And it's required that I, from time to time, take advantage of my knowledge of the 12 steps and make use of them. Now, for example, Sandy said that he's always comfortable in meeting, and I am too. And I thought about that. I got to give a talk on the 12th step in Las Vegas next weekend. And I was thinking, well, 12th step, what is it? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to practice these principles in all our affairs. What principles? Stop and think. What are the principles of the 12th step? There are no principles in the 12th step. The 12 steps, what are they? They're good actions, but there are no principles as such. But when you look at them in a different way, there are principles. I believe that every time I go to a meeting, I work the first step and the second step and perhaps part of the third step. That's what it's about. And I must, as the world goes along, try to make use of these things. About a year ago, I was up in New England at some sort of thing, and I spoke, and the last speaker was Bob Darrell from Las Vegas. And he gave a talk on another use of the 10th step. He talked about how that, of course, we should go around and say, well, we're sorry, we've made an error, but maybe we ought to look over our lives and look at people who put up with a lot of crap from us that we just take for granted. Go back and find people who did things for us that we would never do for them. We would never stay around. I wouldn't stay around being treated the way I treated people. And I thought about that on the way home, and I thought, of all the people I know that I've been insufferable with, my wife certainly is the champion. And I got home that night, late Sunday night, and I was tired, and she was in bed sleeping. But I wrote a little note for her, kind of a funny note, saying I wanted to just tell you how much I appreciate all the years that you put in, and even though we don't always get along very well, you've been certainly loyal and true. And I made it a little funny, I guess. And I got up in the morning, and she was still sleeping, so I went to work. I just got to work, and I had a call saying from my daughter saying, Mother just died, hurry home. And I hurried home. And I was pleased because she had died such an easy death, but my daughter couldn't quite understand. She said, she was having a cup of coffee and laughing and holding this funny note and saying, wasn't this a nice thing? And you know what that did? That just took about 80 pounds of remorse out of me to do that. There's so much in AA that you should do. Not because it's good, but I think for this reason. This sounds kind of abstruse. So it's the sort of thing so next year or the year after that, I don't have to look back and say, oh, Jesus, I should have done that. I should have got to my mother. I should have got to my father. I know my father left my mother and I when I was a boy, and I resented him for many years, didn't talk to him for 10 years. And after I got sober, about 4 or 5 years, my family moved in back from me. They came from Dallas and moved back to Los Angeles, and we tried to live together. And my father, I didn't have anything to do with him or his wife, his new wife, who I thought was broken up our family. But he called me one day, he said, Clancy, I'm so sorry to bother you, but Would you, my wife Val just died. Could you possibly come home and help me get through this? I don't have anybody else. And I thought about that later. Under normal circumstances, I think I would have said, that's the way I felt when you left Mother and I. Why don't you just man up and get through it? But at that moment, my family had just been there a short time, and they brought dogs and cats. One of the cats was going up the curtain in front of me, and Christine was yelling that Kathy had worn her slacks or some goddamn thing. And I said, I'll be right there, Dad. And I went up there, and we got through this, and at the end, we sat and had coffee in his kitchen at first. And I had the effrontery to say, gee, Dad, how do you justify to yourself leaving Mother and I? It screwed up my life. I went from being a student to a runaway to get another service, you know. And I've been screwed up about it ever since. And one of the reasons I have stayed married is I want my children never have to go through that. He said, I don't understand what you're saying about it. He said, you don't seem to understand. I always loved you very much, and I tried to help you, and you turned on me, and your mother and I decided we should separate, and so we did. And after that, you were so cruel to me. And he said, after you got out of the service and came home in 1946 and got married finally, were never home, but I used to bring sacks of groceries over to your house so I could see my grandson, see my granddaughter. And I always loved you, and it just broke my heart that you hated me so badly. And I thought, huh, I never thought of that. You know, you don't see it from that angle at all. And I thought, my God. And I went home and thought about that. Poor Dad. And we got quite close after that, actually. And we got very close. In fact, he moved out to California and lived with me. And then he was about to die. He wanted to be like an old elephant, go at the elephant graveyard. And he went back to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and died. And I was holding his hand. And the only point of that was this. If AA hadn't, in a sense, forced me to try to make a connection with him, to this day, if you'd ask me about my father, I'd say, that old bastard, he's dead, and I hope he's in hell, and I hope they're eating him up with knives and swords. But as a result of AA, I say, well, yeah, my dad and I were separate for a lot of years. We didn't see each other very well, but once we understood that, we got along very well, and I hope my dad is dead now. I hope he's in Valhalla, which is the Norwegian heaven, and I hope he's holding me a seat next to him, and I'll be along pretty soon, and we'll have a few laughs. And just those little tiny things, and it's really just working the 12 steps, just doing the little things that they're not so dramatic, because they don't always work. I remember going to Dallas to find someone to explain why I stole the pickup truck and wrecked it. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm an AA now, I'm trying to make things right. He said, what are you doing in AA? I said, well, I'm an alcoholic. Why did you think I did that? I thought you were a jerk then, I think you're a jerk now. And I thought, how true. But I'm not a great authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't understand this new concept of going through the book. We have a couple of people in our group who started doing that, sidling up to new people, say, can I take you through the book? And I guess that's good. It doesn't hurt anything. But I always think to myself, Bill Wilson never took anybody through the book, and Chuck Chamberlain never took anybody through the book, and Chuck Chamberlain and my sponsor didn't take you through the book. What he says is, do that! And did it enough times so that the magic of AA happened. And that magic of AA, I wish it were a feeling of spiritual oneness with God, but it isn't. What it is, it has gradually made the world around me a better place. The world always seemed very bad to me. I committed suicide in 1955 and went to the Texas Insane Asylum for a long time over that. And I was cold sober. That's one of the problems. I was trying so desperately to stay sober down to my dead son that I got so bad I committed suicide. And I would say, that isn't much of a thing to say, but what does making a man, what does going to a meeting have to do with that? nothing. But doing these things gradually, I think synthesize it this way. Many times, I've sponsored a lot of people over the years, and I've listened to a lot of inventories, and I've done a lot of things. But sometimes people ask me, what is the purpose of AA? And that is kind of, you don't hear that very often. Well, to stay dry, drier, and drier, and drier. God, I'm 55 years dry. I may just burst into flame up here. I believe the goal of AA, and I believe, I would hope that Bob believes this, and I think Sandy believes this, and the people who are successful at AA believe it. The purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality, to make me something that I'm really not, to give me confidence and ability to live in the world, to find myself doing decent things without remorse. And that's really what we entered. Not for you, Four Eyes. Oh, sorry. Give me another chance to work the steps. God. Have you seen my jacket? Yeah. I better shut up before I have to fight my way out of here. But Alcoholics Anonymous is the cornerstone of my life. I still go to meetings. I still sponsor people. A group that I founded some years ago just because I couldn't get elected anywhere. Celebrated 50 years a couple weeks ago. And it's the biggest, largest group in the world now. And we go there every Wednesday night. Your speaker tomorrow morning, Sharon, is the ex-secretary of that group. And every time I walk in that room, life begins better. And then other nights I go to the meetings and feel good. Because that's what it's about. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, is when I do not go to meetings, I stay the same. I don't change. But everybody around me slowly goes to hell. Just nasty, rotten bastards. And I have to go to meetings just to shape them up. So when you see me at a meeting, I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for you. And I hope you remember that. Thank you.